Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blasingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc. All rights reserved.
Welcome back. It's 12 after the hour. I'm Jim Blasingame, the Small Business Advocate, and I'm glad you're here. Dave Durand is with us, ladies and gentlemen. He's our new friend. He's a best-selling author, executive of the Cutco Company, a $250 million a year company. He's a trainer and a motivational speaker. He's trained thousands of people all around the country and halfway around the world, and he talks about what motivates people. What does it take to keep people motivated? His new book is called Perpetual Motivation. His name is Dave Durand, and he's our new friend. Dave, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jim. It's great to be here.
It's good to have you here, and you know, Dave, I just got through interviewing David McCullough, the noted author, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of the two most recent books, John Adams and 1776.
Yep.
And one of the things we were talking about was how what motivated the founders to do what they did. What would motivate them to do something that no one had ever done before, that they didn't even know many times what they were doing. They didn't really understand the total impact of what they were doing, but there was just there was something that was driving them.
Yeah, they didn't have the blueprint that people would have today, that's for sure.
No.
It's interesting. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, it's interesting when you think about that, because their level of motivation had such it was operating at such a high level of basically almost a natural law level, that they knew what was happening wasn't the way people should live, and they were driven towards something better.
Well, they were motivated first, I think, for freedom.
Yes.
Ralph Waldo Emerson said, "We began with freedom." But freedom was a new word to that time, but they were also motivated once they cast the die. They were also motivated to succeed, lest they lose their lives, because they were in danger of that. And it made me think of small business owners, Dave, because sometimes people will ask me if I'm working hard, you know, and I say, well, I'm a small business owner. I don't have a choice.
Right.
So I'm motivated, you know. As you study people, as you've done in your career, what have you found motivates people?
Well, of course, there are several different things, and speaking in particular to that small business owner, the small business owner has an interesting kind of buffet that he needs to work with, or she needs to work with, in that, like you said, just by default, as a small business owner, he or she must be motivated, but because there's so much at stake. But then they have the employees, and a lot of times there's a frustration because a small business owner is frustrated because the employees do not have that same level of incentive, that same drive that they
right.
have. So the motivational game is entirely different. They try to manage them like themselves, and it doesn't always work. And what really drives that person is, I think what you said first and foremost, is that freedom. But what happens is companies confuse motivation in the workplace, and they look at it as primarily a financial thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the financial thing, finances, actually, whether they're bad, medium, or good, can equal kind of an imprisonment. And that freedom is really what that entrepreneur is driven after. So to help people step away from only looking at finance as the motivator or as the solution, because there's much more than just that.
And you're speaking especially of employees, aren't you? And one of the things we know, as I've reported on the show many times, and as other guests have reported, that when you look at the survey of why people leave a company, the reason for those reasons that they left, the top two or three or four, maybe even the top five, have nothing to do with money.
Right. And isn't it ironic that that's where people go for the solution all the time?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, but obviously money is not always money, no matter what level you're at, usually is a source of frustration. That's why we have athletes that get $55 million contract and they complain because it's not enough.
Right.
You know, it doesn't really matter what the level is, because all of a sudden it goes beyond needs and wants in life, and it becomes an ego thing. So what I discovered in Perpetual Motivation writing this book is that there are things actually outside of the workplace that affect motivation inside the workplace. And all the listeners right now, many of whom are people who, of course, are the business owner themselves, but I know you have other listeners. If they've ever been in a position of leadership, this is one thing that a leader knows. They were never taught this in school. The people are going to come up to them during work hours, and they're going to say, okay, I need your help on something, or I'm not going to be able to work tomorrow because. And what follows is most times something that's not directly related right to the work itself.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, I don't know how to do this report, or I'm having a hard time finding these strategies. It's, my health isn't good. My relationships are bad. I'm having a hard time handling my own finances.
Right.
You know, I have stress in my life. So most of the things that actually derail a person from effectiveness or motivation in the workplace are things outside of the workplace.
Mm-hmm. Well, how does an employer deal with those things?
Well, you know, that is an interesting question. It's actually, that is the million-dollar question. If employers could really figure this out the best way, they would never have a problem with turnover. It is a culture, really, and culture is always one of the biggest solutions when it comes to keeping employees motivated. But how do you create a culture that it has to do with things outside of the workplace? And one of the ways to do it is to look at objectives more than hours. And this does get a little tricky and dicey, especially depending on what the actual role or position of the employee is. But for the most part, if it can be set up where the company says, listen, here are your job responsibilities. This is what must be done by the end of the day. Now you don't need to ask me if it's okay that you can go get your hair cut or pick up your son at daycare, okay? Mm-hmm. If you want to go ahead and do that, go ahead and do it. Just make sure that this list of things is done at the end of the day. And now all of a sudden what you're doing is you're giving somebody the ability to what I call spin the plates of life, spin
right.
all those other plates without feeling imprisoned by them, to have some freedoms and liberties to do that.
All that has to begin with what we used to call an open door policy.
Yeah, it does.
People have to feel that they have access to you and that they can tell you the truth, and that if they tell you the truth, you won't overreact.
Right, exactly. And if the culture is set up that way in the first place, what happens is they really don't even, you know, at a certain point, feel the need to report this to you. They don't say, hey, I'm going to have to be gone for this, that, or the other thing. They're just simply gone, and if you look over there and you notice that they're not at their desk. Now, of course, this depends on what their role is. If their
right.
job is to answer the phone all day,
right.
it's different.
The receptionist role is a little different.
It is going to be a little different. So they look over at the desk, and they're not there. But that employer, if they really are setting it up the right way, they
right.
don't really care because they're going to look at those responsibilities
sort of,
at the end of the day.
It's sort of like what Lincoln said when the other generals were complaining that Grant was drinking liquor. He said, well, find out what brand he's drinking and get it to my other generals.
Yeah, right.
Stand by. We're going to take a quick break. It's 20 after. Dave Durant is our guest. His book is called Perpetual Motivation. It's 20 after. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
I ain't got no woman just to call my special friend.
Welcome back. It's 23 after the hour. I'm Jim Blassingame. The small business advocate, Dave Durant, is our guest. He's the author of Perpetual Motion. My website, folks, is www.smallbusinessadvocate.com. Hope you'll use it to your advantage, including the archives, the articles. You can subscribe to my newsletter, which comes by email on Sunday. You can subscribe to my blog, which we'll send to you 5 days a week, or you can just come and get it. Use it to your little heart's content to help you have the maximum opportunity to be successful. Dave Durant has a website too, don't you, Dave?
Yes, I do. DaveDurand.com, and Perpetual Motivation is linked right there.
All right, and that's D-U-R-A-N-D, one R in the name, Dave Durand. Okay, Dave, you've got a formula that you identify in your book, the motivation formula, and I want you to talk to us about that.
Well, basically what this is that I discovered a group of people that I call legacy achievers, and these are people who get more done in a shorter period of time with what seems to be less effort than anyone else. And I, you know, I was not inspired by people who have short-term success. They're successful for a week, a month, a year, even 5 years.
The sprinters.
Yeah, the sprinters.
You're going for the marathon, folks.
You know what? Yeah, because the world-class marathon runners can actually run a mile at the pace of most people sprinting.
Right, so right.
It is an amazing thing. They're efficient. And basically what I discovered is there's this unconscious formula that they live by. And things included in this are having a good, solid sense of humor, having creativity, things that a lot of people go, okay, yeah, I understand that. I can see that. You know, you have to be able to get through life with those types of things. But then there are a couple of other things in there, too, that most people wouldn't think too much about. One is the importance of balance in their life. The other is the way and the style in which they communicate and the impact that has actually on their motivation. And then the third thing is one that is radically countercultural today, and that is self-esteem. And when I say self-esteem, I mean the opposite. I mean that they actually ditch the idea of self-esteem, which is taught all over the place. Now, I am clearly not an advocate of feeling bad about yourself. It's not an attitude. It's not that type of thing. But there's a denotation and connotation with self-esteem. Many people would go out there and use the term self-esteem, and I would support it and believe that what they've said is a good thing. But the problem is that self-esteem, and tragically in our educational facilities today too, and my mother is a teacher. I have two sisters that are teachers in schools, some in private, some in public schools, high schools, grade schools. So this is something close to home for me too. And what happens is self-esteem is taught by way of motivation and everything else as a mechanism to achieve results, when in reality, self-esteem is the benefit of formed behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you tell somebody, hey, go ahead and feel good about yourself, and then as a result you're going to perform, more than likely the person isn't feeling good because they're not performing. And so if you just get them to bite off a little step, a little action, a little new behavior, they will all of a sudden feel different, and it will build upon itself. But the first step is always that. And there's a lot. I have a pretty extensive portion of the book on that because it's a sticking point for a lot of people. And basically, a bottom line is people who focus first and foremost on self-esteem will perpetually be miserable.
You're saying that you should start with performance.
Absolutely.
And find your self-esteem through as a result of that performance.
Right. If you go to, in fact, most of the people that you even probably interview or have that are successful running a business, you say, tell me about the strategy that self-esteem has played in your success. They're going to kind of go, okay, well, you know what? I've been too busy to think about that. Okay.
Right.
And then, but if you were to say, but how do you feel about yourself? They would say, well, good. You know,
I feel fine. Yeah. Well, the thing is that when I think of people who begin with self-esteem, I don't think of self-esteem. I think of self-absorption.
Well, and there's a big difference between those two. And in fact, actually, if you go from the psychology department, self-help department, moving into the business department of even books and authors, a lot of the business books, these books are a little bit more of a hard-hitting type of a thing. They're, hey, listen, you know, corporations know that self-esteem in and of itself would be neat if it helped people get results. But the fact of the matter is we need to get real results, so let's focus on what works. Here's a couple of examples of it. I have a friend who's a teacher in Toronto. They are not allowed to fail somebody.
Wow.
Absolutely not allowed. And the reason is because it would be too much of an impact on their self-esteem.
Well, or babies.
You know, yeah, if you let a fourth grader turn into a 12th grader and they don't know how to read, and you think you've protected their self-esteem, really, in fact, what you've done is probably the greatest attack on it.
Well, you probably created a terrorist.
Well, you probably have. And, you know, the thing about it that's interesting is that is very different than business self-esteem.
Right.
When business people talk about self-esteem, they're talking about more of that positive attitude, that self-encouragement, all these different types of things. And that's one of the reasons I distinguish this, is because if the small business owner talks to the 12-year student and they come in and they're using these words of self-esteem, they're coming from two different places.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just very important that we teach people how to get results. So I go into the history of self-esteem, where it comes from, what's valuable about it, and what's dangerous about it.
Well, if what you do best is talk about how good you are, then that's what you call, Dave, runaway self-esteem.
It is runaway self-esteem, and one of the ways of looking at it is if you drive with a mirror for your windshield, sooner or later you're going to crash. You know, all you can see is yourself. You can't see where you're going, and it's so important to get off of that. I had somebody just recently say, well, if you've got somebody that's so low, you need to motivate somebody, okay? And they're so low, they have absolutely no self-esteem at all. Isn't important to give them some self-esteem in order to get them moving? And I said, well, listen, how many times have you been in a conversation with that person or anyone else who doesn't feel good about themselves?
Right.
And we going to break?
No, we have to wrap it up. But we got more to talk about. Will you come back another day?
I would love to.
Dave Durand, ladies and gentlemen, the book is called Perpetual Motivation, wherever books are sold. Right, Dave?
You bet.
And we'll see you next time, Dave. Dave Durant, right, ladies and gentlemen. He'll be back. I will be, too, after these messages with Eva Rosenberg, one of our top tax experts. And stay with me. I'll be right back.
Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blasingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc., intended for the private use of our audience. Except as otherwise provided by copyright law, all other copying, redistribution, or publication without prior written consent is prohibited. All rights reserved.